Okay. Well, welcome, Truth Seekers. This is the Mike Malloy Program. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy all week long. Don't sweat it, Tony. It happens. We're broadcasting live out of Los Angeles, Hollywood, Burbank, beautiful downtown Burbank at K-Talk AM 1150. Yeah, we had a bit of a panic hitting on the air. That's par for the course. Anyway, I'm Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy all week long. Brad Friedman, that guy from bradblog.com. Yes, that's right. Your friendly sit-in investigative journalist blogger. Yeah, I'm back. Get over it. You can stop on by Bradblog, the open thread there at bradblog.com. I'm going to do my best to keep an eye on that once we get caught up with a few technical issues over here for a change, right? Whenever I go on the radio, it's, you know, I'm poison. Radio poison. And welcome to it. We got a big show ahead for you. Don't worry, this will all smooth out. We got a big show ahead for you, and we will take your calls at 877-520-1150. I got to repeat that a few times because it is not Malloy's normal number. If you call over there, I don't know what you'll get. Maybe Mike and Kathy down in Florida, wherever they are. So give us a call here, 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. Coming up on the show today, big show. Stephen Zunis is going to be joining us at the bottom of this hour to talk about the latest in Iran. Eric Bullard from MediaMatters.org is going to be joining us. He's got a new book out, Bloggers on the Bus. It's about the 2008 election and the effect that bloggers had. Guess what? I'm not in it. I don't know how that happened. Don't laugh, Desi. I don't know why I'm not in that book. So we're going to find out about that. Later on, we're going to have Mimi Kennedy joining us. Mimi Kennedy, the advisory chair of Progressive Democrats of America. She is also perhaps better known to you as Dharma's mom from Dharma and Greg. She has a new movie out called In the Loop, which I saw over the weekend. It is really good. It is really funny. It's a political dark satire, I guess. Black comedy, is that what we call it? She's going to be here in studio. That's right. I told you, we're in Hollywood. And also going to be joined later in the show by Marcy Winograd, who is a progressive Democrat.
Real one.
Yeah, a real one. You remember progressives, right? Who's running against, in the primary next year, against Jane Harmon. The beleaguered Jane Harmon. The Jane Harmon who was heard on wiretaps working out a quid pro quo with a guy from AIPAC trying to promise to help get the AIPAC indictments dismissed from the Department of Justice or something. And by the way, they were dismissed. I'm sure Jane Harmon had nothing to do with it. Marcy ran against her, 2 years ago? Did not win in the primary. She's going to take another run at it, and not a moment too soon, says me, because I think we could use some more progressives out there. Maybe that's just me. No, it's not just me. It's a lot of people, including Bill Maher over the weekend. I don't know if you heard that. We ran the video at Brad Blog. We might play it later in the show if we can have time. Maher said, what was it that he said? He said, the Democrats have, we don't have two parties in this country. We've got only one because the Democrats have moved to the middle, to the right, to the center right, and the right has moved to the insane asylum. He has. You've been watching Fox lately? It's crazy land over there. And we'll talk to Bullard about that in a bit. Anyway, some breaking news. I want to got a lot going on today. Breaking news right now in D.C. Six now dead in the Washington area. Metro train collision during rush hour there today. Two metro trains north of downtown D.C. killed at least six people right now. Another nine injured. It's a mess. The crash occurred just before 5 p.m. on the busy rush hour commute there on the above ground track on the Red Line near Tacoma Park, Maryland, according to D.C. Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. At least nine people have been hurt. We will be keeping our eye on that. Not good. Other news today, some stuff out of the Supreme Court. And frankly, well, one good, one bad. The Supreme Court will not revive a lawsuit that former CIA operative Valerie Plame brought against former members of the Bush administration. The court on Monday refused to hear an appeal from Plame and her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. A lower court last year had thrown out the lawsuit in which Plame and Wilson accused former Vice President Dick Cheney and several former high-ranking administration officials of revealing her identity to reporters in 2003. Plame and Wilson said that violated their constitutional rights. Yeah, it did. It violated my constitutional rights as well, by the way. And the fact that this case was thrown out, the fact that Scooter Libby walked, the fact that no one may go to jail, no one will be held accountable for outing a covert CIA operative because George Bush wanted to have his damn war, well, kind of pisses me off. And right now, as far as any recourse that the Wilsons, Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson may have, it looks like they may have run out of options with the Supreme Court telling them to get lost. I hope to talk to Melanie Sloan later in the week from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington almost sounds oxymoronic right around now. Anyway, we'll try to get some more information from her. I spoke briefly via email with Joe Wilson this afternoon, and he is referring all comments to her. For the time being, George Bush's father, by the way, had mentioned, what was it that he said about folks who would out our CIA operatives, that they are the most insidious of traitors? Talking to you, Dick Cheney. Talking to you, Scooter Libby. Talking to you, George W. Bush. And all those folks who didn't give a damn when we outed a covert CIA operative. Not just any CIA operative, but a knock. Woman under non-official cover. The kind of woman who, had she been caught in a foreign country, had her cover been blown in a foreign country, this nation would have said, oh, we never heard of her. She would have been killed. We would have never fought for her. Put me in a good mood, hasn't it? Supreme Court, some slightly better news here from the Supreme Court today. They ruled 8-1. 8-1. The only dissenter? Any idea who the only dissenter was on this? This is the voting rights case. And actually, we're going to have to take a break shortly, so I'm going to have to get into this a little bit later. But the good news is the Voting Rights Act suit, the lawsuit to essentially gut the Voting Rights Act, the essential provision that required states that have a history of disenfranchisement of minorities. They were trying to gut that, basically, and get rid of that provision, saying, well, it's 40 years later now. Racism is over. We've got Barack Obama in the White House. Everything is fine. We can get rid of the Voting Rights Act now. Well, thankfully, the Supreme Court disagreed in that 8-1 ruling. Oddly enough, Clarence Thomas dissented. Yeah, I know. So he wants to get rid of that. I guess he thinks that everything's fine. There's no racial injustice in this country anymore. They did, however, make a narrow ruling that the town, the water district that had brought this case to the Supreme Court, that they would be given some preference in reconsidering whether they have to be cleared, get pre-clearance from the federal government before they change their election laws. This is meant to protect people. This is meant to protect democracy. And for all the folks who are in D.C. right now yelling and screaming and making noise about Iran, that they're concerned about democracy in Iran. Where the hell were they in 2000? Where the hell were they in 2004? And how is it that they allowed this case to even get this far to the Supreme Court for the Voting Rights Act? Luckily, the Supreme Court stood in the way. We're going to talk more about Iran after we come back from this break. Tony, okay? We in good shape now? You feel better? Okay. Everything's going to be all right, my friend. You're listening to Brad Friedman on the Mike Malloy Show. Much, much more straight ahead. And Tony's going to go mop the sweat off his brow. What could possibly go wrong from here? Brad Friedman, back in a minute. Brad Friedman in for Malloy all week long. What could possibly go wrong? Glad you're with us here. Coming up, Stephen Zunis at the bottom of the hour going to talk about what's going on in Iran. We're trying to keep our eyes on the D.C. situation where six have been killed in a metro train collision. But you know what's been going through my head all weekend long as I've been watching these wing nuts? And believe me, I'd be happy to beat up on Democrats all week long. They deserve it. And guess what? We're going to. But the fact of the matter is, watching these Republicans, we've got this thing exploding in Iran. And you've got a Republican Party that is so damn desperate to find anything that they can use against Barack Obama that they're willing to. I could not believe what happened to the idea that foreign policy on these sort of issues, sensitive issues, the disagreements stop at the water's edge, that we get behind the president. Now, the president has been very measured, as far as I'm concerned, in his response to Iran. No, he has not been timid. And I realize CNN and Fox and MSNBC that you don't have reporters out there in Iran, in Tehran, so you've got to find something to talk about. And no, I don't want to hear about Twitter. So you've got to come up with something. What are you going to come up with? Oh, Republicans, they're criticizing Barack Obama. He's not strong enough. Can I run this clip, Tony? This is over the weekend. Lindsey Graham and John McCain. This is just a sample. I mean, we heard this from a lot of them. Here's what they had to say about Obama as he's dealing with this crisis.
There's a monumental event going on in Iran, and you know the president of the United States is supposed to lead the free world, not follow it.
And again, it's not so much about Iran, although it certainly is at the moment, but it's also about being on the right side of history.
No, John McCain. Oh, John, it's about you trying to get. You were on the wrong side of history. You lost the election, my friend. Here's what Obama had to say on Saturday. 4:15 p.m. on Saturday, Obama said, issued this statement, "The Iranian government must understand that the world is watching. We mourn each and every innocent life that is lost. We call on the Iran government to stop all violent and unjust actions against its own people. The universal rights to assembly and free speech must be respected, and the United States stands with all who seek to exercise those rights." As I said in Cairo, he goes on, "suppressing ideas never succeeds in making them go away. The Iranian people will ultimately judge the action of their own government. If the Iranian government seeks the respect of the international community, it must respect the dignity of its own people and govern through consent, not coercion." I think that was pretty damn clear. I think it was pretty damn strong. I think it was appropriate. What it is that John McCain wants and Lindsey Graham wants... Do they want... What is with these? Are they suggesting that we should bomb these people? We've got enough. Don't we have enough going on? Don't we've got two wars? You know, an explosion went off in Iraq over the weekend, killing 33. There was an attack on the Bagram Air Force Base in... airport in Afghanistan. Two people are dead. Two troops are dead. And these guys apparently want us to go to a war with Iran? Are you kidding?
It's well documented that we have, for quite a long time now, known where the real problem is in the Middle East. And in fact, the president adequately described it as the axis of evil. I guess my question is, how many times do we have to prove that these people are blowing up people now, never mind if they get a nuclear weapon? When do we send them an airmail message to Tehran? That old Beach Boys song, "Bomb Iran." Bomb, bomb, bomb. Anyway.
That's hysterical. John McCain singing "Bomb, Bomb Iran" in 2008 when he's running for president. Is that the kind of presidential behavior we should expect from you, Senator McCain? The guy who wanted to bomb these people, the very people who are out there in the streets, you wanted to bomb them last year, you and your party in 2007, and now you're upset that Barack Obama is not being tough enough. You need another war, Senator McCain? I think we've had quite enough of that. On this one, I'll support the president. 27 after. Brad Friedman in for Malloy all night long. Steven Zunis right after this. After the hour, Brad Friedman in for Malloy, who's on vacation all this week, somewhere in the wilds of Florida, so I'm told. Give us a call if you'd like to talk about Iran. We're going to talk about that for the rest of this half hour here. And, of course, I was ranting how ticked off I am at the Republicans using this as an opportunity. The opportunism is incredible. The depths to which these guys will sink right now at a time of crisis like this is rather extraordinary. So give us a call if you like. 877-520-1150. That's different than Malloy's usual numbers. Don't call him. Call us. 877-520-1150. I'm joined by Steven Zunis, the professor of politics and the chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. I've been following his work, his commentary on Iran over at the Huffington Post over the last couple of days. Welcome to the Malloy Show, Professor. Oh, there we go. Welcome to the Malloy Show, Professor.
Hey, great to be on.
All right, great to have you. Let me ask you, do you have contacts? Are you learning this just like we are from the media, from the Twitter? Or are you able to speak to anyone inside Iran to get a picture of what's actually going on out there?
I haven't spoken directly to people in Iran, though I've been in contact with people who have been.
Uh-huh.
And it's just pretty crazy. It's on the one hand, it's real exciting that people are mobilized to the degree that they are, going out in the streets and everything. But it hasn't been much coordination. I mean, any struggle that you're in, whether it be an armed revolution and a war, or whether it be a nonviolent struggle like this has largely been,
mm-hmm.
or a regular political campaign, whatever, it needs to be strategic. You need to really think step by step. This seems to be mostly spontaneous, and you know they've done some remarkable things. Really, shook things up quite a bit. But there's also kind of figuring out, well, what's next? What do we do now? How can we sustain this? How can we translate this popular anger into real change?
Now, you wrote recently at Huffington Post. You sort of gave us a great history of the history of civil insurrections, as you called it, going back like 100 years or so in Iran, where we have these cycles of popular uprisings, revolutions. How is what we are looking at out there in Iran today, how is that similar to some of these uprisings in the past, and how is this one different?
Well, it's similar in a lot of ways, in that there's the idea of these massive demonstrations, strikes, popular contestation of public space, who runs the streets. And this has been going back for over a century. I mean, the late 1800s, the tobacco strike and other strikes against the concessions given to British interests by the Shah of that era. There's a constitutional revolution about 100 years ago that forced the absolute monarch to allow for a parliament, to more of a constitutional monarch.
And is this how power traditionally changes in Iran? It comes to these sorts of uprisings?
Well, traditionally it's been handed down in the monarchy, if you go back far enough. But there has certainly been, in modern history, this has been a major tool. Of course, one of the nastiest transitions, there are a couple of them. One was a British-backed coup in the mid-1920s, where they got a semi-literate army sergeant who was friendly with British interests and made him the new Shah. And then when his son was temporarily driven out by by more democratic forces, of course the U.S. Brought him back in a coup in 1953. And so one of the ironies about, of people talking about, we've always supported democracy and freedom in Iran, as George W. Bush once said, was that the last actual democratic government that country had, the CIA overthrew.
Right.
Well, we put the Shah in power and kept him in power for a good quarter century. We armed and trained the Sabak, his dreaded secret police. He was pro-American, but a real tyrant. And he was so effective at crushing the democratic and secular and leftist and moderate resistance. And when they finally had the revolution, it came out of the one place Sabak couldn't totally penetrate, and that was the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a very strong anti-American and kind of fundamentalist overtone. And while the revolution itself was broad-based, where it was largely nonviolent, like we've been seeing today, only even bigger, with millions of people out on the streets and strikes and all that kind of thing, there was this power struggle in the ensuing months. And so within 18 months of the success of the revolution, some real hardliners ended up taking over and have more or less remained in charge ever since.
And that's why I'm struck by the tone I'm hearing out of D.C. and these people who are, calling on Obama to do more. I mean, he came out, 2 weeks ago in Cairo, really for the first time, outright acknowledged the role that the U.S. played in the coup back in 1953, and seemed to be making amends for that, if you will. And it seems as if these guys now want him to turn around and do the same thing and intercede into this country's struggles, whatever they may be. That's amazing to me. Now, that said, I've been hearing from people all week since the election saying, can't you tell, Brad, this is a CIA job from the get-go. Ahmadinejad, he was going to win. He did win. Everything was fine. And, of course, I've argued that we have no idea. It's speculation either side because, guess what? The ballots were counted in secret. So we, in truth, have no idea who won and who lost. But they're suggesting that this entire thing is a CIA, an intelligence operation.
That is really silly. I mean, in 1953, Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, our CIA spook there, did bribe some leaders in South Tehran to get a mob to start rioting. That was a few thousand. That wasn't the hundreds of thousands that came out. It wasn't the riots that brought down Mossadegh. It was a military push that took place around that time. The riot was one of many efforts of a destabilization. So there's no comparison. And the CIA can certainly stage coups and do that kind of thing, but they can't organize a popular uprising. For one thing, I mean, it's kind of like saying that it's like Reagan saying the revolutions in Central America were part of a Soviet hit list and it was all hatched in Moscow. It had nothing to do with the exploitation of the peasants and oppression of people there. It was all this plot in Moscow. I mean, it's just a silly story.
Okay, well, let me push you a little bit harder on that. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco. Let me push you a little harder on that. Yes, I agree. You know, the people we're seeing in the streets, the hundreds of thousands, the millions, obviously these were not organized by the government. But is it not possible that whether it's U.S. intelligence services, British intelligence services, anybody, that they essentially set up the conditions for this to happen? I remember leading into this election about 2 weeks ago, people were already talking in the media, there's concerns it's going to be rigged, and there's been a popular uprising for Mosavi. Is it not possible that our intelligence agencies helped to create the conditions that when Ahmadinejad won, that suddenly this would cause the folks to say, oh, wait a minute, no, this is something has gone wrong, and lead them out into the streets?
Well, no, I doubt that, simply because there's a universal assumption, even by those of us who are very critical of U.S. policy, and most people who know about Iran are very critical of U.S. policy, that Ahmadinejad would lose. His slate has lost the recent municipal elections. His popularity was plummeting because, despite his populist rhetoric, his economic policies have been a disaster for for the poor. He was particularly unpopular among younger people, among women, urban dwellers. His only base of support left really was in the rural areas, and that was less than 30% of the vote. And there are a whole bunch of things around the election. The stunning uniformity of Ahmadinejad's alleged margins, when elections historically in Iran have varied considerably by ethnicity and region. The fact that the results were announced just a few hours after the polls closed, when in a country of 70 million using paper ballots, the secrecy of the whole thing, the leaks from the Interior Ministry of widespread malfeasance, the fact that despite that outlier poll that's been widely quoted, there are quite a number of other polls that indicated the elections was going against Ahmadinejad. I mean, there are a whole number of legitimate reasons to question. Again, I can't say solidly one way or another, but this is something. This is not just CIA people raising doubts. I think there are doubts all around.
And I hear you. Let me bring in a caller here, if I can work this board here. Let me bring in Randy from Branson, Missouri. Randy, do I have you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. It sounds like you may, and I was going to say agree with me, but not agree with me. I'm trying to figure out what the hell is going on here. I don't really have a position on this. You feel that the results were reflected, in that pre-election poll?
Well, yeah, I had heard no play in the media, but there was a guest editorial in the Washington Post about a week ago by some democracy monitoring organization that explained their polling methods. They said, we did pre-election polling, and the election tracked almost exactly to what their polling showed on their telephone polls. And I've heard that give zero play. There's not a person out there in the corporate media or any media saying, maybe it was on the up and up. Did you know anything about that? Did you read that?
I saw the poll when it first came out, actually. And it was met by derision by a lot of us who were concerned about some of their methodology. Also, I read the op-ed in the Post, and it did get a fair amount of circulation, actually. What made me question was that if you actually read the analysis of the poll at the time it came out, it said that the margins are probably going to be less than what they predicted back a month ago, and in fact it ended up being a lot more. It also said that it was unlikely that either candidate would get a majority, and ends up that they claimed that Ahmadinejad got two-thirds of it. So in fact that very op-ed contradicts some of the findings of the very poll that it quotes, and as I it's kind of an outlier poll. But let me get back to what you're implying and mentioning about sort of the opportunity for Republicans, because the Republicans, 2 days before the election, introduced a couple of resolutions in both houses of Congress that would have strengthened sanctions on Iran just before the election, when the reformists were supposed to win, in an apparent effort to create a nationalist reaction where Ahmadinejad would win. Daniel Pipes and these leading neocons were going around saying that, hey, we prefer Ahmadinejad because he is more obvious an enemy, and the trouble with most of me is that he's not really that much different.
That's exactly that.
But he's going to be, but he's going to be harder to be the enemy we love to hate. Harder to be the guy we can attack and use to undermine Obama's policies of rapprochement.
Yeah, that's one of the problems. Speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis, hang on through this break, Professor. I want to bring in some more of these calls. Yeah, that's one of the problems with this theory that it was the U.S. who's trying to topple these guys, when you had on the other side all these right-wingers who preferred Ahmadinejad.
Exactly.
Of course, they might not have been talking and working out their plan, keeping their story straight with the intelligence agencies. But who knows? I tend to be with you, Professor. We're going to take a quick break here. Brad Friedman in for Malloy on the Mike Malloy Show. More of your calls and Stephen Zunis right after this break. All right. treatment at bradblog.com in for Malloy all week. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis, Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, about developments in Iran. I want to try to get a bunch of your calls here if I can before we go to the top of the hour. But quickly, Professor, you had mentioned the 1979 revolution went on for, you say, 18 months before the government finally toppled.
Do you see
that happening? Can these guys hang in there that long, or does this go another way?
It could go in any way. I mean, it could escalate dramatically in the next few days and weeks, and throughout the hardliners in short order. It could be crushed only to come back, 3, 5, 10 years down the road, like with Solidarity in Poland. Or it could be something that indeed goes on for a year and a half or more as in waves, as it did in Iran 30 years ago.
And predictions at this point make no sense because we're all just guessing.
I really don't dare. But what I can say for fairly confident is the day that the hardliners are thrown out is closer as a result of the events of the past week. How much closer, I don't know, but definitely closer.
All right, let's go to Amir in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Amir, welcome to the show.
Hey, Brad, how are you doing? Hello, Professor. I want to make a couple of points here. First, as far as the revolution of 1979 is concerned, my family was there in 1979, and if the professor can attest to this, the protests and demonstrations in the streets went one continuous chain, like weeks on end, and then basically another one would start up. What happened is the first one started because in Qom, which is the holy city of Iran, there was about 80 people protesting the Shah in early 1978. There was a confrontation between the police and those students, those basically religious students that were protesting. 5 or 6 of them got killed. 40 days later in Tabriz, 40 days there was nothing going on. 40 days later in the city of Tabriz, there was a memorial service held for those students where there was another demonstration. What happened? Police came out again. There was a slaughter again. And then 40 days later in Tehran, same thing. And then it just continued until it snowballed and it built up. So I'm not surprised that things are dying down on the streets, because you'll be surprised. All of a sudden, the next week there's going to be a general strike,
which is what we saw in 1979, yeah. Professor, wasn't yeah. it? Wasn't yeah. that that made the difference, those strikes?
That's why I mentioned waves of protests, because traditionally in Shia Islam there is this 40-day mourning period, and after those 40 days, people come out en masse, and there'd be massacres, and then again, 40 days later, and already, while the shootings have not been as widespread as they've been during much of the revolution against the Shah, there have been people dead. Now we have the advantage, of course, of YouTube, where millions of people have seen the shocking shooting of that young woman, and who's being declared a martyr, which is, again, very important designation in Shia Islam. And it's interesting, the protesters now are using some of the same imagery, the color green, which is the color of Islam, which was big in 78, 79. They're using it now. The shouting of Allahu Akbar, God is great, from the rooftops. That was a similar tactic used back then. The rallying sites, not just in Tehran, but in Isfahan, Tabriz, around the country, same rallying sites they did then. So they're clearly trying to emulate the revolution of 30 years ago.
Thanks for that call. Yeah, you can make it in 10 seconds, Amir. Sorry.
Look, Randy, I got to tell you something. That poll, it was faulty as hell. First of all, nobody in Iran, when they get on the phone, they're going to tell you the truth, that they hate the government. It's a dictatorship, they'll slit your throat. Second of all, what's going on is, it's like comparing a poll that was taken on September 10th that McCain and Palin were up by 5 points, and then if they would have rigged it and won the election by 5 points, and then saying, ooh, look, this poll that was taken on September 10th is exactly the same result as the November 4th election.
Thanks for your call, Amir. I appreciate it. I gotta get out for the top of the hour. I do appreciate that call, and I hope your family stays safe out in Tehran. All right, Professor, yeah, we're going to have to cut this short, I'm sorry to say, but we may have you back throughout the week as things move forward in Tehran. It is a mess out there. Professor Stephen Zunis, Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. You can get more information on him at stephenzunis.org. That's STEPHENZUNIS. WWJS.org. Thank you, Professor, and please stay in close touch over this next week.
I'd like that.
Appreciate it. All right, when we come back, well, I was going to say we're going to turn the page a little bit. We're going to bring in Eric Bullard from MediaMatters.org, although I suspect he has some thoughts on the way the media has been covering Iran. And so those folks who wish to stay online, if you want, stay in there. If I can get your calls in, I certainly will. Eric Bullard from Media Matters, his new book, The Bloggers on the Bus, all of that and much more straight ahead on The Mike Malloy Show. Brad Friedman in for Mike. We even got theme music working, didn't we? Nice work, Tony. You said I was going to throw you under the bus? I would never do that. Although, speaking of, Eric Bullard's going to join us in a minute. He's got a book called Bloggers on the Bus. We won't throw him or you, Tony, under the bus. No worries. Brad Friedman in for Malloy all week long here, broadcasting live out of beautiful downtown Burbank. K-Talk AM 1150. Glad you're with us today. If you want to call into the show, truth seekers, remember, we've got a new 800 number this week only, 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. Next hour, we're going to have Mimi Kennedy, Dharma's mom, in studio with us. Yeah, it's a Hollywood show. Oh, and tomorrow night, Ed Asner. See, speaking of Hollywood, Ed Asner's going to be with us Wednesday, Sybelle Edmonds. Did you guys hear that out there? Sybelle Edmonds is going to be with us, and she's going to be taking your calls on Wednesday. If that means nothing to you, get home and hit that Google and look up Sybelle Edmonds. You'll understand in a day or two. Also, Marcy Winograd is going to be joining us. She's a progressive Democrat. That's a capital P, progressive Democrat, who's going to be running against Jane Harmon again this year. But first, speaking of elections, our old friend... Oh, where's my... See, where's my papers? I'll just make this up as I go along. Our old friend Eric Bullard joins us. He is a senior fellow at MediaMatters.org. He's the author of Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. Welcome to the Malloy Show, Mr. Bullard.
Hey, Brad, how are you?
I'm good. All right, you know what my first complaint's going to be?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So what, Brad blogged, not in the book? Doesn't matter? Changed elections? Changed politics? But no, Brad blogged. All right, so what's your explanation?
Well, I have a very accurate and helpful explanation. I had to cut 35,000 words before my editors let me. And at one point... In the introduction, I did a greatest hits list of like 30 or 40 early pioneers. That got cut for space, and also I thought, if I left anyone out, I'm never going to hear the end of it, so I left everybody out.
Okay, no one believes you, Bullard.
So you were in there.
Yeah, sure I was in. All right, I'll let you off the hook, because I find the book so damned entertaining, frankly, and I want to thank you for writing it. Give us an idea why you did write it. I know that, what was it, 1972, the book The Boys on the Bus that covered the election between Nixon and McGovern. And so this sort of picks up from there, does it not?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I definitely used the title, and that was Timothy Krause's sort of landmark book about, you know, he was the first to sort of pull back the curtain on the political press corps. At the time, very few people could recognize, political bylines, and they certainly were not sort of these celebrities that they are today, and they didn't have brands, and so people didn't really understand, I don't think, the machinations that went on behind the scenes, and there were a small number of gatekeepers. So that book really shed the light on the Johnny Apples and the David Broders of the world, and Robert Novaks, and people then began to understand that there was this whole culture behind that Beltway journalism. And for the blogging, I did sort of want to pull the curtain back and show people that there were sort of living, breathing people in the blogosphere, because usually within the mainstream press, it's sort of this, you know, this faceless description of, you know, the angry bloggers. And I felt over the years that, you know, the press didn't really give them their due. Obviously, there's been a lot written and a lot, you know, discussions about the blogs. But, you know, for instance, I kept waiting for the Washington Post to start publishing some profiles of these people who had extraordinary sort of life backgrounds, and, you know, these completely, this sort of eclectic, unexpected group of ragtag sort of activists,
mm-hmm.
that had accomplished an amazing amount. But the Washington Post, up until I think January of this year, had never published a feature on a liberal blogger. So
yeah,
I wanted to document it. I thought it was serious and important, and I wanted to sort of tell their story. And then I also just sort of used the 208 campaign as a backdrop to show sort of specifically how they had an impact.
Yeah, they ran something last year in the Washington Post. I think it was on Josh Marshall, great blogger.
Yeah.
But you mentioned not on liberal bloggers. Were they covering more, was the media covering more the right-wing bloggers?
Well, sure. If you go back to the 2004 campaign and you know, the so-called Memogate story with Dan, when, you know, the bloggers got sort of drove Dan Rather off the anchor desk at CBS News. I mean, they were heralded as the next, you know, the next coming in terms of new media, and they were going to be this, these right-wing bloggers, these Republican bloggers were going to be these new superstars of the press.
And did they actually profile them and go into their personalities,
sure. I mean,
and so forth?
Sure. I mean, you can find lots of profiles about the guys on Powerline and Michelle Mulkin,
oh, yeah.
and all of our favorites. Sure, that's automatic. You know, if you have an impact in the press, if you get a big following, if you break news, that is the simplest equation of the Washington Post. You get profiled. But if you're a liberal blogger and you do those things, they're just not that.
Crickets. I know. Okay, how do you explain that difference?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, that goes back to my previous book, sort of Lapdogs, and
yeah.
How the press rolled over for Bush and this four-decade crusade in terms of the liberal media bias and conservatives just hounding, you know, the press relentlessly. So a way you prove that you're not liberal in this case is you ignore the liberal blogosphere and you pretend they're not that big a deal and you don't really give them their due. So I think it's sort of the pressure from the right. And reporters and journalists have sort of developed these rabbit ears over this charge of liberal media. And so, again, what's a way to prove that you're not liberal is you pretend that the blogosphere is of no significance. The liberal bloggers are of no significance whatsoever. And in fact, you go out of the way to sort of denigrate them and mock them.
And yet, for all the work that you guys have done at Media Matters, you know, documenting, you know, showing in no uncertain terms that there is not a liberal media.
That's
and
right.
Showing, you know, two great studies, If It's Sunday, It's Conservative, and I think the second one was, what, If It's Sunday, It's Still Conservative,
yeah.
A couple of years later,
yeah.
Showing just how tilted to the right all of these Sunday news shows are. So you guys have made this case over and over again. Has the corporate mainstream media not... Have they not responded at all? Have they not changed at all? Or are we still looking at the same thing we were looking at 2, 4, 6 years ago?
Oh, it's the exact same conversation. I mean, what is one of the recurring media themes in the last couple weeks? It's this... how the press has given Obama a free ride, you know, and Samuelson and the Newsweek wrote a column on it. You know, suddenly pundits are concerned that, you know, the press being too nice to a White House is this grave threat to democracy. In 8 years under the Bush under the Bush administration, you know, the pundits fought off that claim vigorously from progressives like me and bloggers who were pointing it out. But suddenly, 4 months into the Obama administration, and suddenly, you know, this obsequious press coverage is a threat to our democracy. So we're seeing this theme everywhere, that the press is, the liberal press is rolling over for Obama, and again, it's just a continuation of this four-decade crusade, even though, as you point out, if you read Media Matters, this idea that, you know, the press is going easy on Obama is a joke. But it's accepted. It's conventional wisdom at this point.
Well, it is. And, you know, I couldn't help but notice we were talking about Iran in the last hour and the way the media has been dealing with the Republicans' complaints. I would call it opportunism. In the lead up to the Iraq war, when there was Democratic voices complaining about the way things were being run, complained about George Bush, they got nothing. They got no airtime. They got nothing at all. As a matter of fact, guys like Phil Donahue, who had the number one show at MSNBC, he got fired. Driven off the air. And yet, so we see this show, over the weekend, I think I saw more about, is Barack Obama being too timid? Here are these Republicans who say so. Here's this guy who lost the election last year. He says so. So it must be true. It's amazing.
It is amazing. And there really is an extraordinary double standard. I mean, particularly if you go to places like Politico or your Washington Post or other very Beltway-centric news organizations.
Mm-hmm.
The simplest formula for news right now is if a Republican criticizes Obama, it's news. Not only news, it's a big headline. And it's literally, all they have to do is voice a complaint, and it's news. Of course, the party out of power have been doing that for a couple of centuries.
Yeah.
If you go back to the Democrat, not just to the run-up to the war, you're right. I mean, I pointed out Lapdog, Senator Kennedy gave a very prophetic anti-war speech in the fall of 2002, and the Washington Post set aside exactly one sentence in its entire war coverage. So it's not just the pre-war, but anything before and after the war. I mean, the Democrats were holding press conferences nonstop in early on in Bush's administration, complaining, and they were just dismissed as these moonbats and sore losers.
I know.
But Republicans do it. They're serious and they're important, so we must pay attention to what they say.
We must pay attention to what they say and cover it even more than what the Democrats are having to say. It's amazing. Eric Bullard from Media Matters, author of Bloggers on the Bus. Stick with us. We're going to take some of your calls straight ahead. Brad Friedman in from Malloy, 877-520-1150. Dave in Chicago, John in L.A., hang in there. We're going to take your calls right when we get back. You're listening to Malloy. It's 17 after. Give us a call, 877-520-1150. Stop by bradblog.com, or we've got an open thread at the very top of the page. Agent 99 is in that chat room, and I promise to swing by and check it out soon. And, I need to swing by and check out the Truth Seekers over on DU. Hey, guys. All right, we're speaking with Eric Bullard from MediaMatters.org and author of the awesome new book, Bloggers on the Bus. And I get to say that not because I'm in it, because I'm not. I'm just saying it's awesome because I've read it, or at least a bunch of it, and I really enjoyed it. You want to take a couple of calls, Eric?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's see if I can get this board working right. We're going to go down to Dave in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome, and thanks for hanging on so long. What's up, Dave?
No problem. Hey, Brad, I remember you from back in Crawford, Texas, under the tent with Cindy Sheehan and that whole deal. And you're sitting there on a laptop with a little piece of paper taped to the table. Bradlock.
That was me.
I remember. I find it so interesting. The Democrats, liberals, and progressives organized these protests, Washington, D.C., all around the country. The Republican National Convention up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, people got their heads busted, arrested. And the CNN and Fox, all of them, they're all over this Iran protest, wall-to-wall coverage all weekend long. Now, is there something I don't understand about geographical dynamics of our country versus Iran, how it's easier to cover a protest in Iran versus, say, going up to Minneapolis, Minnesota with a camera crew? Is there something
great,
I don't get?
Great question, Dave. Thanks for that. Yeah, Eric, we had some of the largest demonstrations we have ever seen in this country leading up to the war. No coverage. If a demonstration happens and no one covers it, does it actually happen? How do you explain that, sir?
Well, in terms of the pre-war stuff, I mean, that was just a classic example of not wanting to deal with it. I mean, I remember the New York Times had a piece on the Washington rally, and it was so bad they basically had to rewrite the story like 2 days later as a sort of a semi 800 word apology, because the original piece said fewer people than anticipated showed up, and that wasn't true. And it was just, you know, the press just doesn't really do protest coverage, and they think it's goofy and they think it's lame, and particularly when liberals and progressives are marching, and particularly during the run-up to the war, when everyone in the Beltway, you know, knew the war was going to happen, and most people had signed on for it. So, I mean, they didn't really want to be bothered with these.
But how do you explain? But how do you explain the difference? They don't do protest coverage, yet they go wall to wall in Iran. I mean, we have protests
that
here.
Well, I mean, a little different. I mean, you know, we're talking about a country that, you know, might actually topple, or it's quite extraordinary to have any sort of demonstrations in a country like Iran. And so, I mean, I think I'm fine with that. I think that's what CNN should be doing, and worldwide news organizations. But it does, as the caller suggests, it does sort of highlight the complete failings when people do, in large numbers, sort of amass and demonstrate in the United States, and particularly when liberals and Democrats do it, it's just sort of, you know, it's just completely ignored because the press doesn't take it seriously.
Do you find, I know, and I think you and I all see the same thing, and we're scratching our head, well, how does this ever change? How do you see, or how does Media Matters see the difference between, are you seeing difference in the network? The cable coverage between Fox and CNN and MSNBC over this Iran stuff, are they all pretty much covering this one similarly?
That's a good question. I think Fox, you know, Fox does whatever the RNC tells them to do, or it's just sort of coincidental mind meld. So obviously I think Fox, especially at night and Glenn Beck and in the morning, you know, it's funny, you know, the old saying used to be like, well, Fox just does news all day, but then they do opinion at night, so that's okay. It's like their op-ed page. And now it's like they do opinion at night, okay, then they do opinion during Glenn Beck, okay, they do a opinion during Fox and Friends in the morning. And now it's like there are these little three-hour windows where they're supposedly do news. But so, you know, Fox is doing whatever the RNC is doing, which is attacking Obama from the far right for not, you know, doing the John McCain bomb Iran. But I think the networks and the other sort of serious news channels are covering it pretty similarly. You know, they're having trouble getting people there, and the story seems pretty obvious, so I don't see many differentiation among everyone else minus Fox.
Eric Bullard of MediaMatters.org. Please buy his book, Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. It's really good stuff. Wish we had more time with you, Eric. Thanks for joining us, my friend.
Talk to you soon.
Back after this on The Malloy Show.
Darkness had descended all across the land. A lone voice in the distance uttered, yes, we can. He gave good speeches, never sweat. He was real good at the internet. He's Barack Obama, he's come to save the day. He passed the major stimulus for the said he had the deficit. He, ha ha, stop unemployment, money dies. His healthcare and his spare time. He's Barack Obama, he's come to save the day.
jab video. It's frickin' brilliant. It's really good. It's really funny. There's more. Here it comes. Crank it, Tony. If only he would do all those things. Brad Friedman in for the mic on the Mike Malloy Show. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. Yeah, that's the new video from Jib Jab. The song is great. The video, even better. We got it over at BradBlog.com. It's really good. It's like Spider-Man good. The special effects, yeah, the final shot of Barack Obama standing on the top of the White House holding the flag. I mean, it's really, really impressive. All right, 877-520-1150. That's the number this week, unlike Mike's usual number. 877-520-1150. Have the entire half hour to take your calls here. Coming up in the next hour, Mimi Kennedy, the lovely Mimi Kennedy, is going to be in studio with us here. So if I can make these phones work, let's hit a couple of them here. Who's been holding? John in Los Angeles has been holding forever. Thank you, my friend. Welcome to the show. What's up?
Yeah, Brad. Yeah, yes. I really like both your guests because peace in the Middle East is the most important thing for the U.S. And the key to it, I think, is media coverage in the United States. You know, this big lie that, well, Israel's in danger of being pushed into the sea. Nobody believes that in Israel. The only people that believe that are Americans.
The key to everything is the media coverage. And the reason we're in the soup that we're in is because the media has failed us from top to bottom. But I guess I don't need to tell you that, John.
I mean, you know, you can't make a guerrilla war against the U.S. military or Israel's military with suicide bombers unless you can't be saying, well, you know, they're not bad. After we force them to give us the West Bank for our Palestinian state, then we're going to be friends with them. You got to villainize them just like they've done to Americans and to Israelis. You know, they're just Satans and rats, and they deserve to die. Nobody believes that anybody's really going to push Israel. Israel has 200 nuclear weapons, which Britain has 180. In 30 minutes, they can destroy all of Europe and North Africa and the Middle East and the eastern third of the U.S.
Well, and thanks for that thought, John. I mean, they do need to defend themselves. I don't begrudge Israel that in any way. I begrudge the way they defend themselves and the way they go overboard in defending themselves. And they have nukes, but nobody else gets them. Why? Because they're our friends. That's the way it goes. All right, let me go out to Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. How are you, Brian?
Hey, Brett, I believe this breakdown of the American constitutional government and its system founded by our founding patriots, it began really in the phony election of November 1980, the October surprise that preceded it, and the coronation in January 1981 of Ronald Reagan. And, you know, there's a prescient book that your last guest, he probably knows a lot about, but Professor Bertram Gross, he published it in 1980 called Friendly Fascism, The New Face of Power in America. It tells all of what has come down now from the corporatist America. We are deep into corporatist America. And what we have now is we had the 2004 election clearly mm-hmm. stolen, 2000 election clearly stolen, national election to elect this inbred blue blood George W. Bush, totally unqualified man to be president of the United States, 8 disastrous years, the non-acting the Securities Exchange Commission, he had not the 9/11 attacks, that somehow allowed for hours 9/11 attacks. I'm an ex-Marine. I know other Marine pilots, jet pilots and all that, they would have been on there at like 5 minutes is an eternity to a jet fighter. It's absolutely an eternity. Ask like the brave jet fighters, you're just talking about Israel there too. That country is not to blame for our Iraq war. We did that ourselves for the war profiteers and the oil.
We did it ourselves, and we looked the other other way when these elections went south on us, when we couldn't see our own ballots,
now,
when we couldn't count these elections.
Now we're going after Iran's official media for their so-called the allegedly stolen election, and that we've been so passive, the sheeple in the national media. That's what I was going to ask your guest, about our own stolen elections. How do we stand up when our official media, peacefully, when our official media is knocking us down at every turn, and especially when they finally, the NSA, the Fourth Amendment is dead in the water in this country. Barack Obama is probably not going to really try to save it. If they shut off the internet in this country, what are we going to do?
Oh, man, I don't even want to think about that. Brian, thanks for that call. I don't even want to think about what happens if if the internet goes away at this point. It gets real scary. And, Brian, one thing you can do, I don't know that Eric Bullard would have had any answers for you on how to get the media to do their job. I mean, what those guys over at Media Matters have been doing, have been documenting, for years now, showing in no uncertain terms, and no, they are not who Bill O'Reilly makes them out to be, these vile left liars, nonsense. If you read their stuff, it is so well documented. It is so just, here's the facts, here's the facts, here's the transcripts, here's what they did. So I don't know that Eric would have any answers. I don't think I have any answers. I do know that, Brian, you were calling from the Manchester, New Hampshire. They had a problem with their election in 2008, and it was real damn difficult to get anyone's attention, including Barack Obama, who could have had the entire election counted for $2,000. Dennis Kucinich had to step up on the Democratic side. He paid about $60,000 to have a small partial count. He couldn't get that $2,000 deal because he wasn't close enough. On the Republican side, Albert Howard, a little-known candidate, came up with $60,000 there to recount that side. Most of that money came from Ron Paul folks. Where are the democracy patriots in the media? Why aren't they covering this stuff? Why does democracy only matter in Iran? I don't know. All right, let me get to Dorian, Long Beach, California. Dorian, you're on the Mike Molloy Show with Brad. Oh, Dorian. Oh, did I do that right? There we go.
Yeah, hi.
There.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Dorian?
Oh, fine. All I can say anyway is that I do hope those people over there do get justice. It's better than what we got in the year 2000 and the year 2004. And I hope anyway that they will overcome their obstacle and have a new election.
Thank you, sir. I hope.
Yeah, and also I want to leave you with this 9/11 Mysteries on DVD called 9/11 Mysteries.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
The call, Dorian.
Bye-bye.
Give us a call 877-520-1150. I got a couple lines open. That's 877-520-1150. If you're calling Mike's regular number, you ain't going to get him. You got to call us out here in Los Angeles. Let me get to Will. In Brea, California. Hey, homie, what's up, Will?
Hey, good morning, man, or good evening. I did the same thing through your telephone. It's nighttime. I just want to say, hey, I'm so glad to hear you again, dude. I haven't talked to you since the, filibuster to the filibuster on the Young Turks.
Man, is that the last time you heard me?
That is
noise?
The last time I heard you. I was so glad to hear you again, dude. Where's your regular program?
Dude, I got no regular program.
What the hell's wrong with these people?
I know,
man.
It's crazy. What are they thinking? But I got a regular blog. You can stop by bradblog.com. Okay. All right, we're going to move on to Nora in Minneapolis, if I have this right. Do I have it right? Oh, Nora.
Right.
Hey, Nora. Welcome to the Molloy Show. What's up out in Minneapolis?
Hey, well, she told me to focus. I had two subjects. One was about the Franken, but she said I should focus on this one. And this is it. After 30 years, I have to commend the mainstream media for finally stepping up about the problem of the war on marijuana. And specifically, today on CNN, it came around the second time about this mayor in a town, I believe it's called Berwyn Heights, in Prince George's County, Maryland, some police had confiscated the package that had their address on it, put it on their front porch for them, and had a SWAT team waiting. And when they picked it up, brought it in because it had the wife's name on it, he set it on a table. The SWAT team came in, smashed down the mother-in-law with handcuffs, killed the two dogs, and then arrested the mayor with his shorts and said that he was crazy because he tried to say he was the mayor. And he is the mayor.
Wait, is he the mayor?
Yes.
He's the mayor, and he was
the mayor of this town called supposedly Berwyn Heights or something, some suburb town or whatever.
So I haven't seen any of this coverage that CNN is doing on the marijuana issue. Have you been watching there? They've had a
last
special
week. It was
lesson
on all, every single night.
Was it any good?
Anderson Cooper.
Was it any good?
It was, you know, for and against.
Yeah.
It was half and half.
Okay.
Of course, to me, it's like, it's a harmless thing, like eating celery. Why is there a law against it?
Yeah, it was
balanced. There shouldn't be anything wrong with it.
Exactly. It was balanced. It was like when it's sunny outside, we have to say that some say it's raining. Even though we can go out and look at the window and see that it's sunny. All right, before I let you go, Nora, and I got to get to a break, since you're from Minneapolis, you wanted to say something about the Franken.
Well, it's very briefly, we have a weekly show called Almanac, and they have these people come on, and it was professors of politics, et cetera.
Yeah.
And here they clarified that the Supreme Court is sitting here writing a 50 to 60 page report.
Yeah.
That's why they say it's taking so long, and they expect it to come out this week. Everyone's expecting it this week, but I didn't realize that they have to write 50 and 60 pages.
Yeah, well, they do. This is what the election trial court, the three-panel judge, they also took about 2 or 3 weeks because they didn't want to get second-guessed at the Supreme Court level, the state Supreme Court level, and I suspect the state Supreme Court doesn't want to give Coleman anything to go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, they
want to
cover every base so that it's completely, like, lock-proof or whatever you call it.
Yep. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Nora.
Thank you.
Good hearing from you. People are complaining about how long it's taking to get a senator in Minnesota. Yeah, it is. But not because of the court system, not because of the laws, because of Norm Coleman, because the Republicans want this to go on as long as they can possibly keep 60 votes out of the Senate. The law is good, and frankly, I wish other states had a similar law where they would not send a certificate until all election contests were settled. All right, we're going to take more of your calls after this break. Give me a call, 877-520-1150. Got a bunch of lines open. Would love to hear from you on any damn topic you want. Brad Friedman in for Malloy. We'll be right back.
Arrows of neon and flashing marquees out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all on the same street.
Beautiful downtown Burbank. Here in the studios of, I'm in Stephanie's studio, actually. I'm in Stephanie's chair. Is this Stephanie's chair, Tony? Stephanie's chair. I'm here in Stephanie's chair all week long, and couldn't be happier. I'll leave her little love notes, because you know what? I ain't waking up at 6 a.m. when she's on to see her in person. From home, I can... all right. Anyway, give us a call if you like. 877-520-1150. We've got some open lines that we can try to hit before the top of the hour when Mimi Kennedy, Progressive Democrats of America, and of Dharma and Greg, and of the new movie In the Loop, which is not even out yet, but I saw it over the weekend. And we're going to talk to her about that, and we're going to talk to Marcy Winograd in the next hour tomorrow night at Asner. On Wednesday, Sybil Edmonds. What more could you ask for? Strange story coming out of South Carolina. Governor Mark Sanford kind of disappeared. This Republican governor. This is from Slate. As of 4 p.m. Eastern time today, he had gone missing. Lady Jenny Sanford told AP that her husband had been gone for several days and she didn't know where he is. his wife didn't know where he was. The governor's personal and state phones have been turned off. He has not responded to phone and text messages since Thursday, a source said. Jenny Sanford said she was not concerned. His wife is not concerned. She said the governor said he needed time away from their children to write something. The governor's office issued a statement Monday afternoon saying, quote, Governor Sanford is taking some time away from the office this week to recharge after the stimulus battle and the legislative session and work on a couple of projects that have fallen by the wayside. About, 2 hours later, over at Talking Points Memo, Zachary Roth writes, so the where in the world is Mark Sanford story is only getting weirder. The office of the lieutenant governor, Andre Bauer, is now telling reporters that the governor's office says it's reached Sanford and that he's fine. Bauer would take over the governor's duties in an emergency because he's the lieutenant governor. But here's the thing, writes Zachary Roth. The governor's staff himself doesn't seem willing to confirm that directly to the press. Instead, Sanford's spokesman released the following statement. Quote, Governor Sanford is taking some time away from the office this week to recharge after the stimulus battle in the legislative session to work on a couple of projects that have fallen by the wayside. We are not going to discuss the specifics of his travel arrangements or his security arrangements. A few hours later, a second statement. The governor put in a lot of time during the legislative session, and after the session winds down, it's not uncommon for him to go out of pocket for a few days at a time to clear his head. Obviously, that's going to be somewhat out of the question this time, given the attention this particular absence has gotten, blah, blah, blah. The upshot is, in neither of these statements does Sanford's office say that they've actually been in touch with him. He's just sort of disappeared, gone off the map, gone off the radar. Zach Roth goes on, indeed, the clear implication is that they haven't been, or presumably, they haven't been in touch with him, or presumably they'd have said so. In fact, it's unclear how closely the office even knows the governor's whereabouts. If it did, why the need to track his cell phone location, which is apparently what they did? And if he told his office, why didn't he tell his wife? Very bizarre. CNN is reporting late this evening that Sanford is now claiming, they're now claiming that he's where? Went hiking in the Desi? Do you have any idea when? Hiking in the Appalachian Trail. Is that confirmed by CNN or is that the latest speculation? His spokesperson is now saying that. And has that been confirmed because I actually talked to them or...
His spokesman sent some sort of written statement to the effect of he's on the Appalachian Trail. But as you said, he did not actually say he spoke with the governor. He just said that is where he is.
Kind of a bizarre story, but they don't seem worried. The wife doesn't seem worried.
They say apparently that he's done this before, that this is something where he'll go away for a few days just to have some time to himself.
This is he's going to be a presidential candidate. Or he's been talking like one.
He's been making noises about that, yes.
Yeah. Well, like, do we want a president that disappears for a few days
at
a time?
That absconds with himself?
Yeah. Absconds with himself.
Is that a word? Can I use that word?
You just did. Well, between him and Ensign, speaking of absconding with oneself and one's girlfriend, yeah, Ensign, he's out of the picture. And incredibly, the governor, by the way, so Senator Ensign had an affair, right? He should have resigned or told everybody else they should resign. He didn't. Now the governor of Nevada is saying, oh, he'll be fine. He feels very badly for him, but he'll be fine. Meantime, the governor's wife is divorcing him because apparently he had an affair. Also a Republican.
I guess it depends on which Republican you are.
I'm starting to think these guys are hypocrites. Brad Friedman in for Malloy. We're back with Mimi Kennedy right after this. Seekers, Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy. Yeah, you're tuned to the right place. Broadcasting live from California, Mike is on vacation all this week long somewhere down there in sunny Florida, so I'm told. So you have me, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, your friendly citizen investigative journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, having fun. We're okay. Everything's all right, Tony. Don't worry. Tomorrow night, Ed Asner is going to join us to talk about his new movie, Up. Have you seen it? Have you heard of it? It's really good. It's really beautiful. And, of course, much more, but I don't have the list in front of me. Then on Wednesday, Sibel Edmonds is going to be with us for at least an hour to take your calls. So you'll want to tune in for that. And speaking of calls, you can give us one right now, 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. I have to give out the number a lot because folks may be calling Mike Malloy's regular 800 number, and that ain't no good. Ain't going to get you to us. But 877-520-1150 will. That'll get you right here to Stephanie Miller Studio, where I, Brad Friedman, am sitting in for Mike Malloy. Did you do all that math? Oh, and by the way, our call screener, Randy Rhodes' call screener. So you see, I'm being held up on the wings of progressive angels all around me. Speaking of progressive angels, hi, Mimi.
Hi, Brad.
My friend Mimi Kennedy joins us in studio. She is the advisory board chair. See, I wrote it down.
Yes.
I know what it is, but I wrote it down anyway. I didn't want to get it wrong. Advisory board chair of Progressive Democrats of America. So far, so good?
So far, so good.
All right. Dharma's mom. From Dharma and Greg.
That's right, too.
All right. And we're going to discuss all things progressive, including your new film, which is not out yet.
Nope.
Unless you're really clever and figure out where to see it, as I did with you over the weekend at the LA Film Festival out here. It's called In the Loop. It's a... now, I was trying to figure out how to describe this, Mimi. A political black comedy? Is that
that's a
farce?
That's a really good way to...
A satire? How do we describe this?
Well, BBC Feature Films did it. We shot it over in London with a British cast who does a regular political satire TV show, director Armando Iannucci.
Right.
So it is about a rushed war in the Middle East that the United States seems to be orchestrating, fixing some facts, as so to speak, around some policy. And it's a total fiction. As
yes,
Armando
I have no idea. Where did this story come from? It was out of the blue. I had no. Yeah, and you play the, what is it, Assistant Secretary,
Secretary of State. One of the many Assistant Secretaries of State that there are in the State Department. I play one that feels that this rush to war is going too fast. James Gandolfini plays a Pentagon general who also feels that perhaps we ought to think about the practical implications before we rush to war. And then these Brits play the ministers and the other underlings of the Foreign Service Department in Britain during a administration.
Tom Hollander, I think, plays Tom the Hollander. Minister of International Affairs.
Yes.
And I don't even know if there is a Minister of International Affairs or not, but he was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And the film was hysterical.
Yeah.
I mean, given the subject matter, it was stunning. I think as I was watching it, I was sort of thinking that it was West Wing meets Fawlty Towers.
Meets The Office.
Meets
the Downing Street Memo.
Yeah, meets the Downing Street. And people were eating it up, laughing like crazy.
Yeah.
I thought it was hysterical. And given the subject matter that we're dealing with, that's no easy feat. But...
No.
It's before the war.
Yeah.
It's as they're trying to stop the war.
Well, the first thing I said in the talk back is there's still a war going on. So the only reason we're...
you might not know it if you listen
to the mainstream
the news.
Press. But
but Bobby Brown and Rihanna or whoever the
hell...
Well,
they're a war in their souls.
Brown.
What you see is the kind of behavior on the part of human beings being narcissistic and thinking about their careers and thinking about how much they're enjoying being in the corridors of power and how neat that is, so that when they're actually talking about mass slaughter, they don't know what they're talking about. And it has happened, not just recently, but it's happened many times. The war system does this. And what's great about the movie is comedy out of tragedy. If you can see the ridiculous behavior of human beings not knowing what they're doing, perhaps you will not repeat that behavior, nor will you accord it any dignity or respect when you see it happening again.
And for these people in this film, and you sort of see the British side and the U.S. side, the diplomats behind the scenes, sort of just below the prime minister level on one side and the president level on the other side.
The deciders, so to speak.
The real deciders,
so to speak.
Right?
Yeah.
And yet the way they went about making these decisions, it was almost like, I want to talk to when Marcia Winograd's going to join us at the bottom of the hour, yes. Because one of the things that struck me as I was watching the film was that all of these people sort of seem like normal people.
Well,
just human beings doing their job, you know, they're not what you see on the TV and the speeches. It's just, you know, you and your, was it your former ex-husband, Gandolfini? Is he
Gandolfini
supposed to be a former ex-husband?
There
was, seemed like there was a past relationship,
yes, exactly.
And you guys were figuring out, well, how the hell are we going to stop this war?
Exactly. That's what we were doing, and who's going to leak this? The real fact. It's the fact-based community versus the what did they call it? The reality-based community?
The reality-based community.
That was a real phrase that was thrown around.
Yeah.
And we are the reality-based community, James and I, in mm-hmm. the movie, in a whirlwind of non-reality-based
and it
communitarians.
The entire tale kicks off because this, the actor's name? Because I want to give him credit, because he's Tom Hollander, his character,
yes.
as the Minister of International Affairs. He goes on some radio show, and they ask him about war, and he says, war is... Unforeseeable.
And that's not on message
right.
That the UK is supposed to be on. The UK is supposed to not be leading in this dance, but following in this dance.
Right.
And Hollander takes a little bit too much of a lead there, and he then has to figure out what the right thing is to say next. You know, there's a wonderful scene at the end where he goes, and now we're going to go to war, and our children will be killed, and their children will be killed. This is exactly what I didn't want to do when
right.
I went into...
And he tries to not. He tries to be a party, to play along, and he's trying to figure out how to speak about this without saying, oh, we shouldn't go to war, or we should. And I think he says that Britain is prepared to climb the mountain of conflict.
Sometimes in order to find the road to peace, you have to climb the mountain of conflict.
Yes.
And then the rush to war crowd takes that and thinks it as a heroic way to talk about the road ahead. And then he's in even deeper waters.
And how much of this was based on his research, what really went on behind the scenes, or is this just sort of gleaned from what we know from the Downing Street memos
yeah.
and just sort of an imaginary tale of what we believe.
Armando Iannucci, having done political satire about the press secretary in the prime minister's office
right.
for years, or I think about 2 years before he wrote this movie, he's very attuned to what's going on. He loves politics. UK, Britain loves politics. He did imagine a lot of it. He has since been told by government officials in the UK that a lot of what he imagined, in fact, happened more or less.
Pretty much right on the money.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's going to the UN, so it's all the steps you have to take legally to go to the UN to get resolutions and so on. It's a very instructive little movie. But in the UK, they've compared it to Dr. Strangelove, which mm-hmm. is mighty praise.
Yeah.
But they have compared it to Dr. Strangelove in terms of its impact for being a film that shows war-loving to be a little bit of a pathology.
Yeah, war loving
as
sport.
As power game is, you know,
yeah.
exciting stuff to do.
Now, you know, we're looking back all these years later as how we went to war. And here
we are, because we're alive.
Well, I know, we're alive to do it, but
yeah.
even the people who are alive, very few of them are doing it. Very few of them are looking back. You know,
uh-huh.
We had the story today that the Supreme Court has now denied Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson
yeah.
the right to get any kind of accountability for the White House having ruined her career.
History's
and
being muffled.
Where the hell is everybody? Is everything solved now? Because
no.
Barack Obama, where are we? Where the hell is everybody?
Well, I would say what you're talking about, the we, is what is the mainstream conversation in America? To what kind of media do most of us have access? And when we do access the news or the media, what are we being given? And agenda building, demand management, these are concepts that are still very much operating. And I think you have to follow the money to understand. The agenda building usually is, here's something that the money wants that's sponsoring this program. And so they're going to make you worried about something that they have the solution to, or they're going to build demand for something so that you will finally then demand, oh, I want this.
So do we not care because the media hasn't reported it, or is the media not reporting it and therefore we don't care. And I'm not saying we don't care, but we're thinking about other things.
I think the media not reporting it, so we don't care. And people are moving on with their lives. There is a different administration in the White House, and people have a great deal of hope that, you know, elections are pretty exhausting. There's a lot of money. People give a lot of money. A lot of money is spent. People suspend their lives. They go to work. And then it's over, and there's an election. PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, spends a lot of 24/7 volunteer time trying to help our House of Representatives understand what the people want. It's a full-time job. So
yeah, that is alone. They're clueless. Yeah. Hold the thought. We're going to come back and talk more about PDA, what it is you guys do, what it is you guys are fighting for, and how many people are out there ignoring you. I'm speaking with Mimi Kennedy, star of the upcoming movie In the Loop, also Dharma's mom, also the advisory board chair of PDA, Progressive Democrats of America. Check them out at pdamerica.org. Brad, in for Malloy. Give us a call, 877-520-1150. If you have a question for Mimi or me or about anything else, more right after this. Brad Friedman on the Malloy program, live from Los Angeles and here in the studio with Mimi Kennedy of Progressive Democrats of America. She's got a new film coming up, and I want to make sure, when does it open? July?
Oh, it'll be out in theaters like July 17th, and then it rolls out July 24th.
And New York, LA,
more cities
thereafter. Try to see it. It's really good. We sort of started talking, turning to the idea of, you know, why do people no longer care, it seems, about this war? And I should give out the numbers. Don't use Mike Malloy's regular 800 number if you want to give us a call. 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150.
I want to say something.
What's the reason?
Very simple. Our attention is turned, and I think with good reason and fruitfully, towards Iran right now.
Right.
The alleged stolen election, just as ours allegedly was stolen in 2004, and the difference in the reaction that the people of Iran are in the streets. The positive thing, and I think things that Americans care about, they react to this news. The good thing is, those are all the people that 2 years ago, the right wing and many others in Congress were hoping that we would bomb.
Yeah, I know.
And now we see, no, we didn't bomb them. And isn't it good? Because look at the people we would have killed.
Yeah.
They're our friends. It's not...
we played earlier John McCain during the 08...
Bomb, yeah. So at that time, Americans were kind of conditioned to believe that it was another country full of sand and poor people scrabbling and not knowing what to do and terrorists were there. Mm-hmm. We have not been educated about the world, and at this moment we are being educated about the world by seeing what's happening in Iran. Now, interestingly,
you think it would be harder at this point to go to war against Iran?
Absolutely,
because the American people have we're seeing these pictures and we're relating, and
that would be under the bombs. And we would get it, that it's not moral, and it's not helpful, and it's not strategic. It's not moral. It's murder.
And it wasn't until in Iraq. We never saw the people, did we? It wasn't until Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 came out, I think. And remember, he was criticized at the time because, he showed happy people in Iran, and they weren't...
In Iraq,
and they didn't do living, they weren't living in the sand,
we
and they were civilized.
We were supposed to think it was a satanic leader, and we were being pumped full of the religious imagery of Satan versus God, and that we had to kill Satan, and if we could just kill Satan, everything would be fine. It's an ideological construct. It's very narcissistic because it's always, you know, God is on our side and the other side is Satan. And now we see the reality. Bombs kill people. And people are like us. They have stolen elections. They want democracy. They went out and tried to vote. They go to college. They have parents. And it's very interesting because you almost can't tell the Iran story as it's transpiring without running into false images that were planted 2 and 3 years ago, because now you have all the mullahs. You know, they're on different sides of the issue, depending, because, of course, just like our religious leaders, they're not all of one side.
And it's interesting because you've got these right-wingers now who are, they're criticizing Obama because he's not being tough enough on the mullahs, and yet, and they're supportive of Mousavi.
On the right mullahs, because there's some other
Some of the mullahs are
good.
Yeah, so they want to support Mousavi, and yet some of these same folks were sort of pushing for Ahmadinejad so they can still have their evil villain.
I know. And it's a good evil scenario, and we got to break out of it. But that's what happens on the news. The reason nobody cares is in the good evil scenario, which are the only two rivers we have to flow our water through of thought, evidently. There's a lot of stories now that don't fit. And that's part of the problem about violence. It's always us versus them. It's right or wrong. It's left or right. And there's so many solutions that lie between.
There are
the
so
two.
Many gray areas and nuances, but the corporate media seems just unequipped to understand it, to report it, to help the American people understand that nuance, to do their job.
Now, could it be because there's more money in war?
There's a lot of money in war, isn't there? We're going to talk about money when we come back with Marcy Winograd and how difficult it is to get some if you're trying to run for office around here. Marcy Winograd is going to join us after this break. Mimi Kennedy is sticking with us here in studio. Brad Friedman in for Malloy, 27 after. Stay away.
It's the right wing singing this one to Marcy. Mama, let me be.
Welcome back to the Mike Malloy program. Brad Friedman in for Mike all week long, live and local from Los Angeles, California. It's 34 after the hour here with Mimi Kennedy, Progressive Democrats of America. She has a new movie coming out, In the Loop. Keep your eyes out for that. Marcy Winograd is going to join us in 2 seconds, but as I was walking back into the studio here, I had noticed that Ann Coulter was on Fox News.
Oh, no.
Yeah. They allow her to go on Fox News. Now, I wrote a story.
She's not news.
Well, she should be news because today, go to bradblog.com.
Oh, I did. I saw
that. Did you see that?
But they're not having her talk about that.
Five months since the voter fraud complaint in Connecticut against Ann Coulter. She apparently voted twice illegally from New York absentee into Connecticut when her permanent residence was already established in New York. So this is a different voter fraud charge than the one that I've been reporting on for the last, I don't know how many years now, 3 years, down in Florida. She got off the hook on that one because she stalled, she delayed, she got her FBI boyfriend to come in and get her off the hook until the statute of limitations ran out. And now I'm wondering what's going on in Connecticut, where it has been 5 months since this complaint was made, and the officials told me, well, it's it's still on. It's still pending.
She's on the voter rolls.
She was on the voter rolls in Connecticut, even though she lived in New York.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Voter fraud. But she's over there. She's in O'Reilly. She was on Glenn Beck the other day. She was on Geraldo. Nobody asked her about this. In the meantime, they're doing this Acorn crap over and over again. And there was no voter fraud with Acorn. But Ann Coulter, different story. They don't give a damn. But don't get me started. I'll save it for another day because I don't want to eat into Marcy Winograd's time. Marcy Winograd joins us, the president of Progressive Democrats of Los Angeles, PDLA. I think that's PDLA.org, is it not, Mimi? And she is, once again, has announced her intentions to be the Democratic primary challenger against the embattled Democratic Representative Jane Harman in California's 36th Congressional District. She joins us now from somewhere here in L.A., but she couldn't make it in. Hey, Marcy, welcome to the show. Nope, I got to do this. There we go. Hey, Marcy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brad. It's great to be with you and Mimi tonight.
We're so glad you could join us here, and I'm so glad we can help you get the word out, you know, about your campaign, because these Democrats, Marcy, are driving me nuts.
And I'm sure they are.
Why? Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I am talking to you right now from Arturo Rodriguez's 60th birthday party. He's the president of the United Farm Workers Union.
Uh-huh.
I'm here at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles. I'm listening to Bobby Kennedy talk about how he traveled with his father through the South, and how the people came to the train and waved to him and were so excited about his father's campaign and the hope that he extended to the world, to this country. And yet, you know, a few years later, these same people were coming out to support George Wallace. And he said, how is this possible?
Yep.
Because George Wallace was the antithesis of his father.
Yep.
And his answer was, you know what? People were looking for hope. My father offered hope, and that's what attracted them. Sometimes people make mistakes. There's, you know, the light and the shadow.
Yep.
But that it's so important that we as leaders, community leaders,
yep,
reach out to those and offer hope and a vision of what could be, as opposed to how terrible things are right now. And I feel that's what's really important in this campaign.
Well, you know, it is, Marcy, but the one...
Ooh!
Is that cheers for what she had to say? Or
Bobby? Yeah, that's
had
the roar
say
of the crowd.
Hope is important, but you know what? Marcy, we had a lot of hope. We put a guy in the White House who promised hope and change, and I don't know that we are getting it, that the Democrats are getting it. I suspect that's one of the reasons why you're running against Jane Harman. You told us, we ran a story at bradblog.com today, where you promised to hold Obama accountable. Why are these Democrats in D.C., the ones who have been privileged to be elected and to serve us, why are they not getting it, not delivering on things like single-payer health care and all of these other things that we expected?
Brad, I have to say, I am as disappointed as you are. I think it's up to us, you know, as radio announcers, as media activists, as grassroots change agents, to really hold these people's feet to the fire. Just last week, Mimi and I were at a healthcare forum sponsored by Congressman's office, where there was a whole panel, and not one person on that panel was there to speak about single payer. Well, that didn't go over so well with the crowd, and the next thing I knew, I was on that panel talking about single payer, and now I hear that Congressman Waxman will be holding hearings, which he had refused to do, on single payer this week in Washington. So I think we just have to keep on.
That's, you know, right.
And we can't stop here. We just, and in terms of the war and the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, I say, you know what? Now is not the time to let up. Absolutely. We cannot think that the anti-war movement has morphed into the elect Obama movement and is now comatose.
Well,
it is time to wake up.
We
right?
have to follow. Follow the money is still one of the quickest ways to political enlightenment. And healthcare, not warfare, is the way that progressive Democrats have characterized what's going on in Washington. I can still hear the Akashic wind.
It might be her cell phone. But we may be asking a lot. Aren't we asking a lot? I mean, the folks turned out in droves, obviously, in 2008. They got a Democrat in the White House, both the chambers of Congress, and now what? We still have to do more to get them to hold their feet accountable?
The job's not over, clearly. The job's not over.
The lobbyists,
very few heroes, right, in Congress last week say we will not vote for that supplemental, another $100 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, my hat is off to Dennis Kucinich, who, as I hear, was the only person who took to the floor of Congress and argued against that supplemental. We need to be louder.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Mimi.
I was going to say the lobbyists are being paid $100,000, $150,000 a year to show up at 9 a.m. every day in some congressman's office to say what they want. They're making money doing that job. No progressive that I know is making money doing that job. They are, you know, doing it voluntarily. There are some people who are paid, but they're not highly paid, and there are not as many of them as there are the lobbyists for the pharma industrial complex, the medical industrial
complex. Compete. Marcy, you need to raise a lot of money to take on this very powerful Democrat, Jane Harman. How
Absolutely.
Do we compete with these kind of numbers?
It's quite challenging because, look, face it, you need $400,000 to $500,000 to run a credible campaign for Congress. That's what it costs.
Yeah.
Can you do it for less? You could, but it would be nice to have that kind of money. So I'm appealing to communities like the Armenian community, the Greek community, the Persian community, to support me and to work not just in terms of holding fundraisers and coffees, but to really walk precincts because we need a very strong precinct operation. We need neighbors in their precincts to take ownership of those precincts and talk to their neighbors. That's the only way we can win. Look, Brad, maybe you know I cannot come up with $500 million. That's the estimated net worth of Jane Harmon. Well, actually, I think she lost $100 million last year in the meltdown.
Whoa.
You're talking $400 million. Okay. I can't compete with that kind of money. The only way we can absolutely compete is through community organizing.
And you know, and that's where the passion does come in, because when you do talk to neighbors and you get through the divisions and the fictions that have been that have conditioned us to see things in as good and evil, people can understand when you propose a solution. And then once you get in the White House and once you reelect Congress people, Dennis Kucinich, God bless him, he did get on the floor of Congress and say, pretty soon the only thing that's going to be left made in America will be war. And he made that connection. You know, nobody said, hey, it's going to be too difficult to make $2 trillion for this war you
want
to fight,
you know,
Mr.
But it's
Bush.
Dennis Kucinich, and so they don't put him on, you know, on CNN, on TV.
Right.
Bill Maher said over the weekend that he didn't even think Barack Obama was liberal. Why? Because he's seen Barack Obama on TV. And he knows that real liberals, Ralph Nader, Dennis Kucinich, they're not allowed on TV. And when they are, they're treated like buffoons.
That's right.
Marcy, well, go ahead.
That's the big challenge. I mean, to legitimize what we stand for. And that is diplomacy, not war.
Thank you.
Not, except war perhaps as a very last resort, but not war as a systemic way of doing business. Which
and
is
a way to punish people
States.
We don't like.
Yes. And I think that the pressure not just needs to be applied not just to those who we identify as hawks, but to those who are our friends as well. Not in an antagonistic or necessarily confrontational way, but we need to ask the chairs of all these caucuses, the Progressive Caucus, the Out of Iraq Caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, when are you holding your caucuses to strategize on how to end this occupation in Iraq, in Afghanistan? When? We want to be there.
And
I want to be there. I plan to be there, and I plan to lead that effort when I go to Congress.
We're speaking with Marcy Winograd, and you can get more information on her run for Congress against Jane Harmon, Democratic Jane Harmon. Marcy is a progressive Democrat from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party you've heard so much about. You can get more information on her at winogradforcongress.com. Is it com or org, or does it matter?
It's .com, and also if you want to stay on top of the latest developments, you can go to my Facebook page, which is Marcy Winograd for Congress.
There you go.
Facebook. You mentioned health care.
Yeah.
Brad, I wanted to talk about that for a minute, because if you watch Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow in the coming weeks, you may just see a commercial. I'm going to start airing a commercial. We raised money through an internet campaign where I am on a video standing outside of Harbor General in Torrance saying I'm running for Congress in 2010, but I, Marcy Winograd, am not going to wait until 2010 to challenge Jane Harmon. I challenge her right here, right now, in front of this hospital to sign on to the most economic, most efficient health care plan out there, and that is Congressman John Conyers' bill for single-payer health care, HR 676. So we're going to take this campaign to the airwaves, and we're going to encourage primary challengers to come forth and do exactly that, because we need to put single payer on the table.
And what's Jane Harmon's position on single payer? Actually, hold that thought. We're going to find out that position after this break. We're also going to take some of your calls. Marilyn, hang on the line there. She Mimi, she saw your movie. That's Marcy Winograd on the line. Mimi Kennedy here with me in studio. Me being Brad Friedman. Gonna take a quick break. Come on back with more from these lovely ladies. 45 after the hour. Brad in for Malloy. Final segment, back with the Mike Malloy Show. Brad in for Mike. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. I've got Mimi Kennedy in studio with me. Marcy Winograd on the phone. Mimi's got a new film out, In the Loop. It's a brilliantly funny anti-war comedy, says me. And Marcy is running against Democratic Congresswoman Jane Harman, the embattled. We didn't even get into her embattlement. But we don't have time for everything. Let me get a couple of these calls in real quick. And then we're going to get Harmon's position on health care, because I'm sure Marcy Winograd has something to say about that. Marilyn, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show.
Hello.
Oh, Marilyn.
Hello.
Calling from L.A. You're on the air. What's up, Marilyn?
Hi. I saw the movie, and it was fabulous. And there's also some... it's gut-wrenching, too, because you realize that's really what's happened. And so it's brilliantly funny, but there's a very serious message. After the movie, my friend and I walked past the federal building in Westwood, which is just like a block away from there. And there was a huge protest going on there with the Iranians, and it was so alive. And I would just like to ask all of you what we do to wake up the Americans to care. I was emailing with somebody who's involved in election protection today who was saying people here are concerned about a stolen election there and they don't care about them here. And, you know, I spend my life doing this, and I know you people do too. How do we wake people up so that they care? Maybe Big Pharma has everybody too drugged. I don't know.
That's a good point.
Thanks for the call, Marilyn. Appreciate it. Who wants to take that? Mimi?
Well, we didn't go out in the streets. We're a really big country, and we weren't given the facts. So, you know, the guy, it was 4 years ago, and the guy who got into power because the election was fudged with is the guy that the media wanted, and so there was a real clampdown. And I also think America is going through tremendous stress financially, and it's been going on long before this meltdown, and people are scrambling and in debt, and they're trying to raise their children, and we can't necessarily go out in the streets. Mm. And all the kids in the universities, you know, if you just had NYU and everybody around New York City, you might see what we've got in Tehran. But the other thing I was thinking driving here is the religious component is interesting. They're holding up there's a culture, and you see this in nonviolence everywhere, when there's a more homogeneous culture, when the thing is pressed, the nonviolent civil disobedience can have a kind of a moral underpinning that everybody understands. And I love our country. We're very diverse. But until we get down to the dignity of human life, all human life, we're not going to have our moral underpinning to send us into the streets yet. We're too divided.
Marcy Winograd, I know you've been a big election...
I just wanted to add one comment to what Mimi said, and that is that I think that there is great potential in our youth, you know, and I look around at what happened in Los Angeles with these budget cutbacks and the mass terminations of teachers and how students joined with teachers. I mean, I was on these marches, marching over to the district headquarters to demand that their teachers at hard-to-staff schools be maintained, be kept, be retained, because we know that schools like the one that I work at, which is at Crenshaw High School, they stand to really lose when you lay off hard-to-staff schools, lay off teachers at hard-to-staff schools. And some of those layoffs were rescinded, you know, a substantial number. Not all of them, not as many as we had hoped, but there were some victories along the way. And I do think that there is great hope in our youth and that we have to turn our attention to them.
And I want to get one more call in here, but, Marcy, I want to give you credit because you've been a great election integrity advocate, as has Mimi and Progressive Democrats of America. But I know you went up, I think it was in 05 or 06, and tried to make a citizen's arrest on the former Republican Secretary of State in California.
Yeah. Mimi and I were in the hall of the Secretary of State's building demanding accountability for having approved these Diebold touchscreen machines and software. We knew it was highly hackable, and we were out there and demanding that we talk to him. Of course, he didn't address us, but we had our life-size citizen's arrest warrant.
We could use an election integrity advocate in Congress, a serious one, and you've paid your dues there, so thank you for that. Let me see if I can get Jeff in from La Habra real quick. Jeff, can you give it to it in about 15 seconds?
Yeah, I just want to say how lucky the people in the 36th district are to have someone like Marcy running. I mean, someone who's progressive like that out here, and I live out in La Habra, and we don't have any progressives here hardly even to vote. So I just, I'm so jealous of the people in the 36th district.
Thanks for the call, Jeff.
It's a move.
Yeah, and we've got to, you know, we've got to help you get there this time, frankly, to make it a contest. How'd you do against, you ran again in 2008 against Harmon.
In 2006, I ran against Jane Harmon.
Yeah, 2006.
I jumped in 3 months before the election, yeah. Brad. And in those 3 months, I was able to mobilize 37.5%, almost 38. Hey, if you want to stretch it, almost 40% of the vote.
In the primary, yeah.
In 3 months. So we know that we can do it, right?
Yep.
We have a whole year to organize, to really decide who's going to take what neighborhood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How involved do you want to be? Because if we want to see change, that change starts with you at the grassroots level. It has to. Like I said, we don't have the money to compete on that level, nor would we want to. We want buy-in of a different kind that is real, you know?
Bless you.
This is about the people.
We want to help you make it real. Check out Marcy Winograd at Winograd for the number 4, Congress.com. Winograd for Congress.com. We've got the links at bradblog.com. That might be easier to find out, to remember. Mimi Kennedy is, new film is In the Loop. Check out, her website, pdamerica.org. Oh, it's a progressive hour around here. Marcy, thanks for joining us. Good luck with
the
race.
Great to be with you and Mimi.
God bless you for all you're doing.
I want all of your listeners to get involved. I don't care where you live. We have jobs for you.
There you go. Winograd for Congress.com.
La Habra will get progressive too.
All right.
There.
Listen, good work. And keep an eye out for In the Loop. It's a terrific film. Very funny. Mimi, thanks for joining me in the studio
it's
here. You're awesome. I got
to
thank everybody here. Engineer Tony Sorrentino, call screener Miranda Moreno, producer Desi Doyen, Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org, Agent 99 at Bradblog, K-Talk AM 1150, and of course, Mike and Kathy Malloy. Thanks for allowing me to sit in the seat. Stay tuned for Head On with Bob Kincaid if you're listening on Malloy.com. I'm Brad Friedman. We'll talk to you tomorrow night.